Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Holly Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. He's just trying to tell you how old I am. See, I know a lot of what he's up to. Yes, I made me 2 days older than rain. I happen to be in the last half of the ninth inning, but I'm still up at bat. First, I want to thank you for inviting me here. It's been very pleasant. Everybody's been very sweet to me. Very nice. It's good to be back here again. I don't know, I must be getting senile. I couldn't remember I'd been here before. Until a lovely lady this afternoon took me over to see the sleeping giant there. And once I saw the sleeping giant, it all come back to me. I remember the whole thing. I love to talk on Saturday night, and I'll tell you why. Because 29 and a half years ago, on Saturday night, I found sobriety. You don't need to give me the claps. I deserve this. And I'll put it this way, I was introduced to sobriety for the simple reason is this. I had heard about AA. Something about it, you know. Not too much. I heard them, they'll give you a drink if you need one. I'd heard remarks like that. And then, another thing that I heard, but and I've heard speakers say it since, but when I was new in the fellowship, I didn't run into too much of it, about all those people, they speak the language of love. They speak from their hearts. They're full of love, yeah. They speak the language of love, sometimes very roughly to you when you're new. And they certainly speak from their hearts. You know, it went something like this, and it had been going something like this for me. And I suppose this was the language of love, and which can be brutally frank at times. But it seems to me, the way it came to me, it was like this little boy whose mother had taken him one time into a department store. And she told him in the very beginning, "Now, son, don't ask for anything, because I cannot afford it." Well, immediately he fell madly in love with a little red wagon there, and she told him she couldn't afford this wagon, and would he please get himself out of it, and he refused to. And the store manager saw the confusion or commotion going on over there, and he said, "Now, madam, don't worry. We have a lovely child psychiatrist on the floor, and he knows just exactly what to say to this youngster, and he'll get him out." So the psychiatrist came over, and he handed this child some gibberage that psychiatrists are known to handle people, present company accepted. But the child, he sat right there. He didn't move. So again, the floor manager says, "Now, we also have a pediatrician that understands children, and he can get him out." So the pediatrician came over, and he told the child that the wagon had been sprayed with a deadly chemical and that was in the paint, and if he didn't get out, it would kill him. Well, it didn't make any difference to him. He still sat there anyway. So there was a minister on the floor, present company accepted, that came over, and he told the youngster, he says, "Now, I'm going to tell you, son, you're just not going to go to heaven if you don't obey your mother and get out of the wagon." The kid sat there, looked at the minister, moody. Now, there's a janitor on the floor. He came over and he said, "Now, I think I can get him out of the wagon." And the store manager says, "I don't see how you're going to do it. Everybody else of note has been around here and have talked to him." He said, "I understand him. I live on the same side of the street he does. I understand him." He said, "Well, go ahead and try. Time's a wasting." So he leaned down and he whispered something in the child's ear. The child got up and politely took his mother by the hand and walked out of the store, to the amazement of everyone. And finally, the store manager said, "What in the world did you say to him to get him out of that wagon?" He said, "I told him, if you don't get out that wagon, I'll break every damn bone in your body." Because my sponsor didn't talk to me just that way, but she wasn't far from it. And it's a known fact, we have come a long way in the fellowship, and I'm very grateful for what I came through. I'm very grateful to the old boys and girls that I met 29 years ago, for the simple reason is they told it to me the way that it was. We didn't have any these places that you can go to now and rehab, we didn't have anything like that. We had detox, and that was just about it, not too much of anything else. We didn't have an alcoholic ward in the hospital. We had a hospital there, the city hospital, and they threw you up in the ward there with the nuts if they caught you out there drunk, clowning and performing, and they would throw you in the psych ward. I remember being in there once. it's a heck of a thing. You an alcoholic and you in ward there overnight there with a bunch of people that, they have problems a little different from ours. And here you are in a straitjacket and they're walking around there with a tin cup and looking down at you and saying, "Aren't you my cousin?" Well, before the morning was over, I was everybody's cousin, you know, because I was scared to death, you know. You talking about being scared sober, I was. But we didn't have too many things then as we do now. And I like to think of it just this way. I got exactly what I needed. Quite possibly, had it been any other way, maybe, just maybe, I wouldn't have come to believe the way that I did. Now, the big book tells me, that our stories reveal in a general way what we used to be like and what happened and what we're like now. Now, I can't stand here all night long telling you what I used to be like. See, that takes too much time, you know? In other words, I remember it goes something like this. The first time I wrote my fourth and fifth step, I could write down two words, phony, phony, because that was just about the result of the whole thing. Alcohol was not one of those things that flowed too freely at home. I grew up in my grandparents' home. My mother and father were deceased, and naturally I had, what you might say, a chip on my shoulder from the word go, because I was an orphan. And of course there were no more orphans in the USA but me. The only one. You better believe it. And I cannot say, I can really identify with the speakers that I've heard when they talk of the scarcity of love in their home, because there certainly was a scarcity of love in mine. Very deeply. I can remember my grandmother sitting on one end of the porch reading the Bible and my grandfather sitting on the other end of the porch reading the Bible. And how them two people ever had seven kids, I'll never know. I never saw my parents again. You just did not even mention the word love. I don't know, they got it all mixed up some kind of way that love meant something else, you know. We just didn't say that to one another. In other words, it was a dirty word, I guess. I don't know, but my mother... My father was killed in the First World War. You can start counting that if you want. And my mother died when I was about 9 years old. And so hence I was home with my grandparents. I had another cousin there that they simply adored her. They didn't tell her they loved her all that much because we didn't use that word. But it was... Action was the magic word right there. You could tell the way they acted, you know. And I was so jealous of my cousin Helen, I didn't know what to do. You know, I was always long-legged and gangly and all like that. And cousin Helen, she was short and cute and plump, rounded out nice. And I was so jealous of that girl. But, you know, I'm not jealous of cousin Helen now because cousin Helen weighs 250. And I'm not jealous of cousin Helen now. She's really rounded out. But nevertheless, I can remember my grandfather always on Cousin Helen's birthday. He always gave Cousin Helen a quarter on my birthday. I said, "Grandpa, it's my birthday. You look at me. You go do such and such thing, you know, pay attention to that." And I'll tell you this one thing that stuck in my mind. I mean, it stuck in my mind. And you know, it wasn't until I came to AA that it was changed. And I was an overgrown woman when I came here. I remember, because now, one of the things I want to impress you with, I wasn't one of those sweet, shy children. I was a mean little son of a gun, I'll tell you that. You know, the word goes because I was mad because my mama died. Naturally, my father got killed in France, and I never saw him as a baby. And so the government naturally took care of me. But I remember my grandfather said to me one day, "You know, if it wasn't for that money," he's getting there, had a guardian there, go down and collect the money once a month, or however, I don't know. But nevertheless, my grandfather said to me, I guess I was about 10, maybe, 10 and a half, "If we had money, we wouldn't have you on the place." Now, you know, that's a hell of a thing to tell a kid. "If we had money, we wouldn't have you." It was not until I came into AA, because I used to lie about something that I had and didn't have, that people would love me and I didn't have anything. You know? Said, when I came into AA and people said, we want to be your friend. I thought you sure in hell are hard up for friends, you know. I couldn't understand how people could care about people, but they do. Now, getting back to my grandpapa again, you know, I thought there were no more alcoholics in my family. It didn't, as I said, the booze didn't flow too freely, but we had a whole lot of sneak drinkers there. So finally, I got old. When I became old enough to understand what was going on, I had a couple of aunts and uncles there that, you know, they stayed three sheets in the wind there. My grandfather had a bottle there of whiskey. Then he had a whole lot of rock candy and meth in it like that, you know, herbs and whatnot. And on wet, rainy days, he would drag in this leg. He's supposed to have arthritis. And, you did have it. I know what arthritis is now, you know. And he'd drag that leg in there, and he'd open this dresser drawer, and he'd pull it out, and he'd take two, three swigs out of that bottle, and he'd rub that leg, and he'd get up, and he'd walk on out. Foxy, you know. I watched him do this on numerous occasions, and one day I thought I'd better try it. And I switched in there, and I pulled open that drawer, and I took me two, three swigs out of there, and I sat and I rubbed my leg that did not hurt. I crippled out of there the way that he... But I found from there on in, one, it wasn't necessary to have a mother or father. You know, what? With alcohol, who needs anybody? You know, as far as that's concerned. As I told you, I wasn't going to bore you with a long blow-by-blow description of my drinking, just enough to let you know that I belong here. Because it's a known fact. Now, you have to agree with this. Maybe you won't agree with everything, but and if you don't, that's your business. But the thing of it is this. If there's not something wrong with you when you come in here, there will be when you leave. See? Because you ain't going to hang around a bunch of people like us, no, 29 years, and then you don't need to. I'll tell you that right now. Because we can be the confusingest bunch of people you've ever seen in your life, you know. But and fall out, and the next thing you know, you see us walk down the street with arms around one another, you know. That's sanity, though. That really is. You know, it's insanity not to speak to people because you're angry with them. You know, that's insane. You know, that's horrible. Well, you know, I suppose in growing up, I did all the things that most young people do and most of the things that young people don't do. I did them anyway. But I had found that I began to carry on a relationship with John Barleycorn that wouldn't quit, you know. Now, sometimes, you know, we think that what we drink is the cause of us being an alcoholic. Well, before I came in this fellowship, I drank anything that was too thin to chew. It didn't make any difference what it was. I drank it, you know. And another thing... you know, we often speak of winos. Well, women are not winos. I was a winette. And, so I made the grade. I got married there. That was, well, marriage is like vaccinations on me they don't take. And the gentleman that I married at that time, he was a gambler. He was throwing away faster than I could drink it up, so I got rid of him. And now I had the perfect excuse to drink. I mean, this was perfect. Because now I got two children to support. And oh, brother, that was, you should have heard. I had a story to tell about them two children that would have made the Statue of Liberty cry, you know. And I'm telling you, and I talked about how my husband had went off and left me. I didn't tell anybody, I put him out. I talked about how I had this dirty scoundrel that walked off and left me and these two fatherless children to support, you know. I could really hold an audience, you better believe it. Now, I believed in on-the-job training, so I got a job in the bar. And, this was very nice. And then when I wasn't working in the bar, I was a part-time bootlegger. I sold some and drank some. And if you're going to drink, you can't be a bootlegger because you drink up all the profit, you know, one of those kind of things. But there's one incident that stands out in my mind, and possibly some of my older friends, I'm not going to say old friends like some people I know. I mean, some of my older friends might remember this, but I just want to show you, I've got to tell you this to bring out my point about how you and I, until we actually stop playing games and come to believe in something, we're not going to get very far. I can remember this one instance. For a long, long time, I just would not talk about this because it was too painful to talk about. But the more I began to think about it, and the more that you taught me that I could laugh, And I began to laugh. I can see that it was kind of crazy. But at that time, it was pathetic. I lived in this very small community, and we had in this small community a lovely little Catholic church there. And we had the four first black nuns in the state of Michigan. And they started to build a school, a three-room school, and, well, they built it and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, they always have the time that they're going to celebrate. And it's just like in AA. You know, do you ever take the people that do the less work and do the most celebrating? Well, that's the way they did. About a week or a half, and two or three people do all the work, you know. But we love them, though. So this particular day, I had done nothing to promote this deal that was going on. But that day was the day of the big celebration. And the poor priest, bless his heart, he had invited all of the dignitaries from over town, all over Detroit, and we lived in Ferndale then, and which was a suburb of Detroit, and everybody was there. Well, Holly was going to go, too. And have you ever felt you heard the call of the wild goose, and you got to go where the wild goose goes? So I got up that morning, I said, I'm not going to take a drink. I don't know why I said that. I just said, I'm not going to take a drink. So I take my little daughter by the hand, away we go. So now on the way up, when I got up there, at the caretaker's house, he had a bottle of that cooking wine, you know, 10 or 15%, you know, that kind of good wine. And I walked back to the caretaker's house, and he was giving all of the parishioners, you know, a drink out of one of those little insult glasses about like that. And I went and I got me a gratitude glass and got me a drink. And you and I know what that first drink will do, cunning, baffling, and powerful. So they ran. Now, before I did this, though, now, I went over to Mother Superior, and I said, Mother, is there anything you want me to do? And she says, no, darling, go and enjoy yourself. I'll call, send for you when I need you. Never tell a practicing alcoholic to go and enjoy yourself. You mess up. So down in the caretaker's house, they ran out of wine, and I went to the drugstore to get them another bottle, and I got them a bottle of that cooking wine, and I got me, you know, my kind of wine. You know, you people wouldn't understand what that was, my kind of wine, you know. Some, maybe some of the younger people might, you know. I always thought it was sophisticated to drink wine, yeah. And you know, how much sophistication are you going to get out of drinking Mad Dog? I don't know. But anyway, by the time that it was for me to go and do what the good Mother Superior wanted me to do, I said, well, maybe she wanted me to help out at the wishing well. Well, on the way over to the wishing well, I thought maybe if I had me something to eat, you know, this might straighten me out a bit. And so one of our good parishioners was making barbecue. And I thought, I'll stop and I'll eat a piece of this. This will straighten me out. And he wasn't putting the sauce on the meat quick enough for me. And I reached down in the sauce with my hand, they tell me, and put the rib down in there. And one of the parishioners said to me, Holly Martin, you can't do that. You know, that woman shouldn't have said that to me. That's the worst thing you can do. Now, they told me I did this. I guess I did. But I took that bone, and when I got through waving that bone around, and as I hit her down across the head, I don't do that, I did. Well, I tried to justify that. I really did. On the way home, I was so ashamed of what I had done, because when I got through waving that bone around, the nuns, you know, in those days, they looked like they'd been killing bugs all over there. And there was no one left on that ground but me and two balloons, you know, I mean, I felt so bad, but I said, well, after all, Samson took the jawbone of an ass and wiped out a whole army. How come I can't hit her with this pig bone? We try to justify everything. But now here's the sad part. When I got home in my living room, I had a beautiful picture of our divine Lord hanging on the wall. And I looked at that picture and I said, dear God, if ever again in my life I take a drink, I said, strike me dead. You know, I meant this. I really meant it. Because you don't play games with him. Okay. The next day, of course, the good father, he wouldn't let this go. He had to make something out of it, you know. So the next day, he sent the two nuns down the street, you know, after me. I tried to write him a note, and he wouldn't accept that. And it was a real beautiful, warm day, and, you know, and the two nuns, they come down and said, Father wants to talk to you. And I said, well, sister, can't we go down the alley? She said, no, dear, you didn't get drunk in the alley. And so everybody came out of the grocery store, the pool room, what's Martin done now, you know. She drags me up the street. Father didn't offer no pledges that day. He's fresh out of pledges, where I was concerned. But he said this to me. He said, "Holly, I want you to promise me you will never take a drink again until you see me take a woman into my house." I readily agreed. But on the way home, I got to thinking. Now, I can't hang around here and see what this man's going to do. I don't know what he may do when I ain't looking, you know? So maybe I better get a six-pack and think about it. So I got this six-pack, and I looked at that picture on the wall, and, oh, Lord, I said, "Lord, I didn't mean beer, you know." So, you know, that same as priming a pump. You know, when we say, "Well, to keep from getting drunk, I'll drink something I don't like," that's priming a pump, you know. So the next thing you know, I was drinking whiskey, and I said, "God, I didn't mean whiskey either." And the next thing you know, I'm right back on wine again. And I said, "God, just forget it, you know. I didn't mean it, you know." You're talking about feeling like a hopeless drunk, I did. So that's the kind of things that I went through. You know, maybe you people over here don't know anything about pawn shops, but I had a watch that a gentleman had given me, and I love this man. And he gave me a watch. Now, anybody you love, you wouldn't pawn a watch that they give you. I pawned that watch. It stayed in the pawn shop so much it wouldn't run on a Jewish holiday, you know. that's just a sample of it. You know, I was in a bad way. And one Saturday night, this is going to be the Saturday night. This is what happened. See, that's what I used to say. This is what happened. One Saturday night, I don't know why, but for the grace of God, I happened to be at home. And I was sitting in the kitchen. And a story came on over the radio, and I did not turn the radio on to this particular station, because in my condition, you hear things all the time anyway. You don't need a radio. But this story came on, and it was called The Glass Crutch, and it was about a woman that had a drinking problem. If it had been about a man that had a drinking problem, I wouldn't have listened to that. All the men I knew had problems. Well, anyway. And it said, "If you ever need our help, we'll be the first number in the book." And I thought, oh, goodness gracious. Broad and quit drinking whiskey and get some wine, she'd be, you know, okay. You know, that story stayed on my mind 6 or 7 years before I came into the fellowship. Now, not every day, every month, every week, but every once in a while, walking down the street, the heel plates on my shoes would seem to beat out the words, "The glass crutch, the glass crutch." And as time, as the clock didn't say tick-tock, it seemed like it said, "The glass crutch, the glass crutch." Finally, one day, I was sitting in the living room, and it seemed as if every word on the paper said, "The glass crutch." And I said, "My Lord, what does this mean?" And I looked down at my hand, and I'm holding the glass crutch. I said, "Harry Martin, you can't even read the newspaper without the glass crutch." Now, I'm not going to be dramatic and say that I immediately dropped the glass and I ran to the phone. I did no such blasted thing as that. I finally, that day did come, you know, when I went to the phone. I looked in the phone book and I said, "They're lying, it ain't it, man." And there it was, the first number in the book. The only liar was me. And I called this number, you know, and I didn't understand the language that we talk now. "Are you having a problem with your drinking?" The lady asked me, "Did I have a problem with my..." No, I thought, hell, I can drink it. I have a problem getting it. I don't know. You know, what she's talking about. So anyhow, she said, I told her first, I said, "I got a friend out here. I think she's losing her mind. Would you send somebody out to talk to her?" And the lady said, "Would you like to have somebody talk to you?" No. So anyway, I was right back on that phone again, you know. And she finally got my name and address out of me, you know, and said she'd have somebody call me. And sure enough, you know, when we got a call, we went, you know. So this lady called me, and she talked with me and said she'd come out to see me. And she said, "Now, if you've got anything out there to drink, you get rid of it." Well, I've always been obedient. I did. I drank it up. And so anyway, she came. But you see, I had reached the stage of zombieism. That is, if you don't drink, you don't get sober. If you do drink, you don't get drunk. You know what I'm talking about? Everybody's a real zombie, man. That's awful. And do you know, alcohol again, cunning, baffling, and profitable. Before that woman could come out there to take me to that first meeting, two of my good old buddies came by, and they gave me a couple of drinks, and it was the same as pouring coal oil on the dying embers. I got drunk. Not drunk, but just high. Too high to go to any meeting, so I thought, but she took me anyway. Right along. And, you know, I hated that woman. I felt about that woman like a lot of men feel about their wives. I wish the hell you'd go away and leave me alone. But don't go so far I can't find you if I need you, you know. And what made me hate her was she was always whipping out this who me on me, you know. Is drinking, you know. Charlotte wants to ask me some stupid question about, do you pick a lower environment while drinking? Why, heavens no. I merely create a lower environment while drinking. Is drinking clouding your reputation? Did I answer yes to three, dear? And you're here. Oh, Biddy must be getting 50 cents a yes or something. Clouding my reputation? What reputation? Who worries about reputation? Yeah. Then she asked me a dumb question. Do you prefer to drink alone? If I'm buying it, yes. If you're buying it, no. And, you know, I thought, how in the hell did I get into such a mess as this? You know, people talk so crazy to you. But, you know, as time went on, I began to love this craziness. What I loved about all of this insanity that was going on was, after I got over that feeling that people do call you up just to see how you're feeling. The first thing, you know, that bothered me was, wait a minute, do I owe to somebody something or other, you know? And, you know, it's beautiful when you find out you don't have to lie anymore and pretend to be somebody that you are, pretend to have something that you don't have. You know, this is wonderful just to be yourself. But it took me a long time to be myself because I didn't know who myself was. Yeah, I did not know. It's just like some of the doggone, the stupidest things that I hear now. I hope you people over here don't hear that kind of stuff. When people tell people, well, now to start all over again, just get rid of that family you have. Just get rid of all of that and strike out and find yourself. Isn't this a duck? Go with everybody you got and strike out and find yourself. No. Oh, you hear some stupid thing. Well, I quit my job today. I'm going to let my higher power take care of me. Yeah, really. Before I retired, well, I was semi-retired, I'm not indispensable. I was telling my friends I still have three classes. It's not that I'm indispensable, but I work with the hardcore alcoholic and everybody's scared of them. But me, I understand why I know. You know, I haven't been one of them. We get along nice with one another, you know. But, some of the things that you hear that are supposed to come out of intelligent people. Before I retired, my boss used to say to me sometimes, Holly, you can keep a client in there longer than anybody I've ever seen. What do you be telling them about? I said, Chapter 5. Chapter 5? I said, yeah, Jerry, whatever. I said, you're alcoholic, ain't you? Yeah. I said, well, that's what we'd be talking about, Chapter 5. Why do you recommend AA for everybody? I said, for the same reason that you in it. That's why. You know? Because, you see, this is where it is. This is where, this is the thing that really and truly put me together. It put the whole world together. I was like the little boy, whose father had never had time to play with him. And finally one Saturday, the little youngster said to his daddy, Cat, won't you play with me today? His father had a lot of work to do. And he grabbed a map off of the wall and he tore it in a lot of pieces. And he said, son, now you put this map together and as soon as you get it together, I'll have my work done and I'll play with you. And in a very few minutes, the child had the map together. And he ran in the room and he says, here it is, Daddy, it's all together. And his daddy says, how in the world did you get it together so quick? He says, well, on the other side of the map, there was a picture of a man. He says, once I got the man put together, the whole world fell in place. And he says, here's what happened to me, you know. So you see, on down the road, I learned this story, this legend, the legend of the white butterfly. And that's what I'd like to share with you tonight, the legend of the white butterfly. There was a youngster. Whether he was born crippled or whether he became crippled shortly after birth is of no consequence, just like sometimes you and I worry. Well, was I born an alcoholic? You drink too much. You know, it doesn't make any difference whether he was born that way or not. You're that way. And so, we have some awful stupid things, you know. The thing of it is to really find the solution to what happened here. So, okay. This youngster, regardless of what the situation was, anyway, he was crippled and he was in a wheelchair. And his father loved him very dearly. And he had had all kinds of masseurs to come in and to rub and massage his legs. He'd had all kinds of doctors to help the youngster, all in vain. And the youngster still could not walk. And one day, his father was down in Mexico, and he found an Indian down there, an Indian chief, making moccasins. And he decided to buy his son a pair of these moccasins. And upon the purchase of the moccasins, the Indian chief told him, he said, There's a remarkable story that goes along with those moccasins. It's called The Legend of the White Butterfly. And when anyone that wears these moccasins, if he has any infirmity at all, if he can simply capture a white butterfly and press the wings of the butterfly to his infirmity, he will be made well. And the man didn't even stop to explain. He said, well, my son is crippled, but I wanted to have the moccasins, and he kept on going home. And he took the moccasins home, and he presented them to his son. But as an aftermath, he thought, I'll tell him the legend of the white butterfly. He just thought that he would. So he told his son the story. But hope was born within this youngster when he heard the story. And every day, he would go down into his father's flower garden in his wheelchair, and he'd try to capture a white butterfly, all to no avail. Yeah, in a wheelchair, he couldn't do it. Finally, one day, he asked his father for a pair of braces, and his father gave him the braces. And he went hobbling down there with these terribly heavy braces, and he tried to capture the butterfly, all to no avail. Finally, he asked his father for a pair of crutches. His father gave him the crutches. But how in the world can he capture a butterfly when you got a crutch under each arm? So finally, one day, he asked his father for a cane, and his father gave him a cane. And he crippled down there with his cane. And he saw a butterfly, and it flew very close to him, and he reached out to capture this butterfly, and the cane fell from under his arm, and he found out he could walk. Now, you know good and well as I do, that it wasn't the remarkable cure of the white butterfly that caused this, but what had been happening all the time was this child had begun to use muscles that he had never used before. And instead of massaging, he began to use the muscles. And hence it is, it happened to me this very way. I began to use muscles that I had never used before. Always before, I had massaged it, lied about it, see, tried to hide it, you know. As I told you, rationalization, always rationalization, you know. Same as masturbation, you're just screwing yourself, you know. I know you're going to say I'm a dirty old woman when I say that. Well, nevertheless, though, when we look at this first step where we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives become unmanageable, like this child, I had to begin to use a muscle. The first muscle was the muscle of honesty. You know, do you really want to get sober for you, Holly? Do you really want? See, that sponsor, as badly as I felt about her, she said something to me the first day that I met her that I shall never forget. I said to her, my children were small at that time, young. I said, you know, I got to do something on account of these kids. She says, don't worry about your children. You do something for yourself. Children will be all right. You do something for yourself. You need to get sober for you. And you know what that woman told me was remarkable. Because my children turned out, in spite of me, to be very fine people. Very fine. I have two very fine people. And I often wonder about this one night. But you know one thing my son said to me when we talk about being fine people? I was trying to explain to him one day. I said, well, son, I'm very proud of you. I never fail to tell my children how very proud I am of them. I said, son, you know, after that awful childhood that you had to turn out to be the fine man that you are, I said, you are a credit to your profession. You're a fine man. He said, and I said, you had a hell of a childhood. He said, well, Mother, we didn't have much money. He said, but we had something that a whole lot of people didn't have. And I said, what was that? And I cried. He said, you loved us. We had love. You know, in spite of it being a drunkard, my daughter told me, Mother, you're my role model. I said, ain't this a duck? I'm a role model for somebody. She said, Mother, because you stay sober, you know. And they both tell me, Mother, you loved us. Well, I did love them. Because I'm going to tell you, it was a possessive kind of love. And you see, this program taught me the difference, how to separate that possessiveness from love. Because when you love a thing, you want it to be free. So that first muscle that I had to use was the muscle of honesty, as this youngster did. I had to admit that I wanted to be sober for me. Because I would be in a heck of a shape with two professional people now. And look what poor old mama gave up for you. Look what poor old mama gave up. And mama didn't give it up for them. I gave it up for me. I gave up puking. lying and stealing and conning, you know. all the things I gave up was tremendous. You know, I had a tremendous amount of things to give up, you know. You know, but the thing of it is that I had to learn was honesty began with me. I had to search myself. You see, when I came in fellowship, I also gambled tremendously when I had anything to gamble with, you know. In other words, I didn't have too much to gamble, but I'd gamble anyway. And I had to ask myself, look, are you a gambler or are you an alcoholic? Well, it didn't take me very long to decide that. Look, if you win, you're going to get drunk, baby, and you're going to celebrate. And if you lose, you're going to get depressed and you're going to get drunk. And if you don't play that day, you're going to get drunk because you didn't play, you know. So you are an alcoholic, you know. So, my friend, honesty. To honestly admit from the bottom of my heart that I wanted to get sober and want to stay sober for me. To honestly admit. You see, it's all right. There's a lot of times we'll admit things just to get people off of your back. You know, if somebody's dogging you about something, well, you can admit, oh, yeah, I did this. But that deep down dark of the night honesty, that deep down sunlight honesty that I can admit, yes, I want to stay sober for me, regardless of what comes or what goes. Because, you see, there's a catch to this staying sober for yourself. That's the funny thing about this beautiful program, because when we get down to the third step, and you have to make a decision about it, and then you find out whether you're staying sober for yourself or not. And like this youngster, I had to use that muscle of honesty. Yeah. And you know, I had to also, when I looked at that second step, I had to, like this youngster, use the muscle of open-mindedness. Yeah. Willing to accept help outside of myself. This thing where we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. You know, there was a willingness to listen to somebody else. Open-minded, you know. But it just didn't have to be what I believed in. Nobody tried to cram religion down my throat. Nobody tried to do that thing. They simply told me that God could and would if he were sought. You see, I believed always that there was a God. See, but you can't believe that there is one, and then there's the thing about believing in him. You know, I would pray, but I'd say, well, I believe that there is a God because I did. But I felt, you know, he just didn't know all the particulars about this. You know, all them other little bitty things, you know, maybe if I could explain them to him, you know, clear. He knew Holly, you know, one of those kind of things. But one of the main reasons that it could be in many instances where you and I might have a problem, or some of us might have a problem with the second step, you know. But kind of like the man that laid by the pool, he'd been by the pool about 30 years, and every once in a while the angel comes down there and trouble the water, and whoever gets in first gets healed. Our divine Lord came by there one day, and he saw this man laying by the pool, and he asked him, wilt thou be healed? Man said this or that, you know, he's like some of us alcoholics at the time. Do you want to get sober? He started telling him something else. Well, you know, before I can get down into the pool, somebody else beats me down there. And our divine Lord simply told him, look, take up your bed and walk. We see, that includes the springs and mattress. In other words, there's many times that you and I don't want to get sober because it entails responsibility. And we'd rather play crazy than to, you know, accept responsibility. You know, nobody's going to ask a crazy person to do nothing. Because many times, you know, your person might say, no, he's drunk, he's crazy, don't ask him. So if I admit that I'm sober, then I am entitled to accept responsibility. And sometimes, you know, we would rather play crazy. And the sickest mind on earth is one that is sick, knows he's sick, and shall we say, capitalizes on being sick. That's a sick mind, buddy, you know. In other words, the fear of responsibility many times keeps us from accepting the sanity of the program. If I come to believe in a power greater than myself and I'm honest enough to admit this, then I must accept my responsibility as a human being. Responsibility as a human being. And I've played a child too long. And I don't want to accept responsibility, and it's better to just give some excuse like the man but a fool. Well, you know, somebody, I would come to meetings, I would join that thing, but somebody else always beats me to it. Kind of dumb, isn't it? Rather than to accept the responsibility of being a free person. You see, when one can be restored to sanity, he doesn't need that little white pill anymore. You know, that little white pill that they call land abuse, you can throw that thing away too. Because God could and would if he was sought. You see, when I first came into the fellowship, now I'm not against it. If you want to take it, if staying on, standing on your head keeps you sober, than standing on your head. That's what I say about it. But I'm speaking about a holly. I don't want any little pill that has more power over me than the grace of God. None whatsoever. And I'm going to tell you this. You're not going to like me, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Well, if you don't like me, I ain't asked you. Could I come over here? You invited me. We were at such a gathering. You know, sometimes pedestrians get on my nerves. There was a young man there, bless his heart. He was newly sober. And he had a beautiful singing voice. He could really sing beautifully. And it was one of those call-up meetings, and people were calling up, and the whole wasn't just for, alcoholics. It was for pedestrians also. And this woman, I just kept listening to her. You know, she just kept criticizing everything that the people were saying, being an open-type meeting. And this young man, he says, I can sing how I feel, but I can't tell you. And she had a son that needed to be there, who was in jail at the time for the same offense. And he got up and he sang, You Saw Me Crying in the Chapel. And there wasn't a dry eye in there when he got through, and she made the remark, This is an awful thing to be doing, that he would stand up and sing, I saw you saw me crying in the chapel. I said, Your son just got put in jail for pissing in the alley. I said, So what difference does it make? So you see, before we start talking about anybody else, keep an open mind. You know? And then this youngster, he had to use the muscle of willingness. Yep. He had to become willing. After I have admitted, and I'm honest enough to admit my alcoholism, and honest enough to admit that I don't want to stay sober for me, and I keep an open mind, I will accept help outside of myself. Stop saying, I can do it. Oh, I know everything. Then there is that willingness. That's freedom. When we look at the third step, that to me is freedom. The freedom to make a decision. Did alcohol ever permit you to make a decision about anything? Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God. This youngster had to be willing to do this. He had to be willing to turn his will and his life over to the care of God. And he became willing. The freedom. Freedom from fear. The fear of what other people are going to say. See, alcohol says to me, if you play on my team, I'm the boss. The first thing, you don't give me anything, I take what I want. The first thing I take is your self-respect. I demand it, and I just take it. You don't have to give it to me, you know. See, God's will becomes man's playpen. As long as I stay within the confines of his will, see, I am free. If you had a baby, a youngster, and you put him in a playpen, you would put everything in this playpen to make him comfortable. You wouldn't put a razor blade or a butcher knife in there, or a saw or something like that. Now, if you loved him, you wouldn't. You'd put everything in there to keep him comfortable, make him happy. And do you know one thing? The little rascal would try to climb out of there anyhow, don't he, sometimes? Look at what you put in there. The best, I mean, he wants out. The baby wants out. And once it is within the confines of God's will, regardless of how many good things it gives us, sometimes we still want to see, I want out of this. And this youngster, he had to use the muscle of willingness. The willingness to stay within the confines of God's will. God performs in very strange ways, you know. And you and I cannot understand them, and it's not for us to understand them, but it's for us to accept them. Because he gives me a freedom. And you know, sometimes God works me like I'm the only child he knows, but he turns around and takes care of me like I'm the only one he's got. Do you know? And hence it is trying to stay within the confines of his will. The privilege of making the decision to turn your life
and your will over to... Sometimes, you know, we think we did a great thing. But I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Big deal. Who else wants it? But one thing, you know, he ain't doing God no favor, I'm sure of that, you know. He's doing me a favor by accepting mine, you know. How many times we say, well, you know, I would do this, but, you know, I don't know how Charlie's going to feel about it or Mary's going to feel about it. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And I love those words, over to the care of. Many people, you know, you think that God's a junk dealer. Well, just over to the care. You know, over to God. Over to the care of. Which means you can take it back any time that you're stupid enough to do it, you know. And I'm stupid many times during the day. Because I still, every once in a while, I do it Holly's way. And that's when Holly has to come back crying, oh, God, I messed up this time. You know, alcohol never gave me this freedom. Alcohol never gave me the freedom many times to get in and out of bed like a human being. No. Sometimes, you know, now when I get down on my knees at night or day or whenever I feel like it to pray, I can get up. How many times does alcohol knock you down and you can't get up? You know, the bed's going around and you say, I'll catch it next time it comes around. You know, when you're in the confines of God's will, bed, stay still, baby. You know, I love that. And then this child, he knew by continuing each day with his crutches, say, or wherever he was, at whatever stage he was in at this particular time, that he was going to have to take an inventory. So he made a searching and thorough moral inventory of himself, like I was told what I had to do, you know. And when people come up, well, you know, I don't want to take no inventory. Well, what are you scared of? Searching and thorough moral inventory. He had to use the muscle of integrity. Utter sincerity. See, alcohol has a tendency to expose the violence in a person, the meanness in a person, you know. All that spite has a tendency to just to expose this to the world. The very things that you and I try to cover up or hide, alcohol wants to let the world know it, you know. And now comes the time of disrobing. Disrobing. See, when the boy was still fresh from the hands of Almighty God, through disobedience, two people, you know, they were got into trouble, you know, because of their disobedience, like you and I and our disobedience, or me. And then the question was asked to them, and the same one has been asked to you and I, that God asked Adam. Adam, where are you? Yeah. Adam, where are you? So when you and I take that inventory, it is because God wants to know, where are you? You know, where are you at? With yourself. That's what a searching and fearless moral inventory is all about. Where are you at? You know, where are you at? It's a disrobing. And you see, like those two people, at that particular time, they, because of their disobedience, they discovered that they were naked. Nude means you don't have any clothes on. Naked means you are defenseless. And that's what they were. Absolutely defenseless. The book of books says they were naked. Defenseless. And they made a garment of fig leaves. Same kind I made when I found out I was defenseless. The first one was pride. That was my first fig leaf. And then it was fear. Yeah. And then it was resentment. And you name it. And I made me a garment of fig leaves. And then when I made, I was given the privilege of making a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. I too, like those two people, could disrobe. But no longer, as I told you in the beginning, it's no longer necessary for me to have to lie about something. It's no longer necessary for me to have to hide behind somebody. I'm going to make mistakes, and you're going to make them, and we're going to forgive each other, and we're going to love one another, and we're going to go on from there. Yeah. As the big book says, we're not saints. We grow along spiritual lines. We're like little children, and that's the way God wants you to be. He said, lest you become as little children, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. And you're talking about childlike, some of us are real brats, aren't we? You know? But many times we are afraid of the pain, at least I was in the beginning. And we don't want to take an inventory because we don't want to be disturbed. Yeah. I'm sober now, and that's all that's necessary. I don't need an inventory. I don't want to disturb myself. I'm just a duck. You know, I'm just... I don't want to do that. I can stay sober without an inventory. El Toro Poo Poo. You can't do it. You got to take inventory, you know. Is that necessary? And so this youngster, he had to take a searching and fearless moral inventory. And then it took courage. The first step. He had to use that muscle of courage where we admit to God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our own. I have a tough titty, but you need the milk. Real tough when that step is, you know. I know it took courage each and every day for this youngster to continue to go down into that flower garden against all odds, but he kept going. And he wondered, how could I have gotten myself into this fix? I learned that after the Second World War, some very strange vegetation sprung up in Europe that had, in England, that had, because of the bombing, it had been years since that type of vegetation had ever presented itself in God's world here. And that was the same way with us. After this, we wondered, some very strange things began to happen. And we wondered, how could this have happened to me? How could I have done it? Same thing. You'd never, ever treated yourself. That ground had never been exposed to bombs the way that it was. And that is exactly what happened. Many times, when we look at the fifth step, and we ask ourselves, how could I have done this? How could you have put yourself through what you put yourself through? Strange vegetation comes from strange seeds that was planted a long time ago. That is all that can happen. In other words, many times in the fifth step, I can take it very simply. Have you ever used your illness just for attention? You know. Enjoy your illness so you can make other people miserable. Exact nature of my own. Misery loves company, and I want everybody else to be just as miserable as I was. You know? Now, another muscle this youngster had to use was the muscle of self-respect. You know. When entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, this youngster, he quite possibly felt like many of us have felt. Now that I am sober, I don't want anybody cleaning up for me. I don't want anybody lying for me. I don't want to hide behind anybody. You see, sometimes when we look at the sixth step, about these character defects, entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. When we look at that step sometimes, and as many times that I know that I used to feel, well, you know, I still need this one. And I'm still keeping myself in prison because I need this one little character defect that I need to nurse on. It's like the monkey, that's stuck whatever monkeys have, hands or paws or whatever, down in the jar because there was 5 peanuts down in that jar. And after he got his hand down in there and he got the peanuts in his fist, he couldn't pull his fist out unless he let go of the peanuts. Now, the other monkeys got wise to this, and they said, so they're sitting out there, and they're looking out the window there, and all the coconuts and bananas and things that monkeys like. They said, let go of these. So they let go. Well, they were entirely ready to give up these 5 peanuts so they could run through the forest, and have their coconuts and bananas or whatever monkeys like to eat and enjoy and swing from limb to limb. But sometimes we can be just like that monkey with them 5 peanuts. You keep your hand right there in the jar holding on to 5 lousy peanuts. And all everybody else says, I'm entirely ready to have God remove this from me. Because it's a burden to me. Because if I say that because of me, I've got to hold on to this temper of mine. Because if I don't, people will run over me. Well, what's that? You hold on your temper because of fear? Well, then why you hold on to the fear? What's the fear for, Because you don't have self-confidence or why? It all goes because you haven't come to believe that God will take care of you? Oh, well, it is. Must be one of those things. Something's done happened here because I don't hear me. Well, if you can hear me, I can too. Okay. Well, maybe that's what it was. I don't know. Well, you can hear me, can't you? Uh-oh.
Okay now?
I don't know, can you? Alrighty. That's cool. So you see, my friends, in order that one might have the self-respect. See, sometimes we think these character defects that we hold on to have got to be great big things. But some of them are just as small as 5 peanuts. Have you ever been around people that have been begging for so long and conning for so long that they can have a whole carton of cigarettes, but then they'll lie and say, you know, man, I left my cigarettes, you know. They always leave them somewhere else so they can bum off of you, you know. You can't open your wallet and you show more than $5, they got to buy three of them. Have you ever seen people, little bitty things? But these things steal one's self-respect. It doesn't have to be a great big thing. It can be a very small thing. But that is that sixth step, entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Let loose of the five peanuts so that I can enjoy them all. Now he had to use the muscle of patience. Patience is a short word, but it's a long time coming. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Sometimes, you know, we begin to get a little anxious. We feel that, you know, I'm not getting well as quickly as other people are. Other people seem to be getting well, and I don't know, I read the big book, and I go to meetings, you know, but I'm not doing as well as somebody else. And we become resentful of this. Very resentful. Yeah, you're going to meetings, and you're reading the big book, but you're not practicing the steps. You know, there's a whole lot of difference in reading the prescription and taking it. You know, I had a friend when I first came into this fellowship. She's about the size of my cousin Helen. And one morning she was going to the doctor, and I was going to AA that morning. And she asked me, was I going to that thing? And I told her yes. And she said, well, I'm going to get down to your size. I thought, fat chance. And that evening I came home, and I went over to her house, and she was just leafing through a magazine, showing me all these nice patterns that she was going to wear when she got down to 14 and all like that. I said, hey, girl, now look at her dinner. I said, did you go to the doctor for your weight? She said, yeah. That child had everything on her plate that you could imagine. It was all the same color, potatoes, rice, corn, and everything else piled up. I said, didn't he give you a diet? She said, yes. I said, where is it? She says, it's in there on the dresser. You know, that was one of the best AA messages I ever got. I could come home and put them 12 steps in there on the dresser, you know, and expect them to work for me. I've got to work them. She's about 250 now, you know. Now, my friends, this child, as he began to get better, he realized that he was going to have to use the muscle of amends. This, my friends, can't hear again. I may be able to pull it down some. How's that? Okay. Yeah, we pull it back up again. Huh? Is that better? Well, maybe that was it, huh? Now, you put me up in front of one of these things, it'll go wrong every time. I've never seen it fail, you know. Well, maybe that was it, huh? Hmm? Oh, you want me to close it in? There you go. Oh, yeah, man. Hmm? Is it all right now? Hmm? Well, you know what?
I think it's in the sign.
No, it's in the wall here.
In the wall?
Yeah, it's
in.
Is there another mic out there?
Ain't that something? Well, you see, now that's when these things happen when you've talked enough. So when you've talked enough, people begin to, the mic gets tired, they quit on you, see. But when it comes down to making amends, many times when you and I are on our road to recovery, and we find that we must use the muscle of amends, sometimes we feel that sometimes we feel, instead of making amends, well, I'll just take so-and-so a little present over. And if I take them a present, I won't have to say anything. You know, that's the coward's way. For a very simple reason is, a present is an excuse for a man that you were too big a coward to make. That's exactly what it is. Many times when it comes down to making amends, We are afraid that I might get my foot back into the same mess I was in before. And I realize that the program has taught me easy does it. I don't want to get back where I was before. Now what's he up to? There you go. Huh? I don't know. I think I couldn't tell you whether it is or not. There you go. Well, maybe that's it. Is that it? Maybe. I had to come all the way down to the States and break something, huh? No, I ain't. Well, it looks like y'all ain't gonna have no dancing tonight. For a very simple reason. Well, let's get on to this amends bit anyway. It is a known fact that sometimes when it comes down to making amends, I found in my case that it has to be easy does it. There are many times that I have found out that when it comes down to making amends, I have to be like a friend told me about a bird that he had one time. He didn't capture the bird. The bird had broke his wing. And he took this bird into his house. And he healed the wing. But this was a robin. And this robin was a wild bird. He was not a house bird by no stretch of the imagination. And finally the robin could fly again. And he let the robin outdoors. And he had a cherry tree right out in back of his house. And this robin would get up in the cherry tree, and the man told me, he said, from time to time, the robin more or less just lived in this cherry tree. And he had a bench under the cherry tree, and the bird would from time to time drop cherries down on his knee, or he'd fly down close to him. In a wet spring, and the soil was shoveled. I bet you are. I just don't want you to blow up.
Don't turn that on.
Who, me? I wouldn't touch it. He don't turn it on.
Don't turn it on.
Mm-mm. And he's going to ask me that.
Okay, now go. Mm.
Try it now.
Hmm? Hey, I never tell me not to turn it on. I know he knows better than that. Come on out and take a bow, Sally. You fix it. So I was going to tell you about this bird. He said many times that the bird would pick up a fishing worm and lay it at his foot and fly away. He never, ever allowed him to get his hands on him again. This bird did not. And as many times as I have found in making amends, I must make the amends, but I will not let you put me back in that position again. I remember the story of this robin. I will make my amends and fly. And sometimes I had to question this amend deal. Because old habits are pretty hard to break, my friends. You know how sometimes you and I can be, you see, remorse, called remorse. Sometimes it's only self-pity turned wrong side out. You know, I'm feeling sorry for myself and calling it remorse. And sometimes, you know, we can crawl on our bellies like a snake. I will get up to you in any way that I can and tell you how sorry I am. So I can get the upper hand on you just one more time, you know. That old conning cleverness is right still there. Amends. I've got to watch that. See, this thing called amends, my dear, can sometimes be misused pretty badly. Because I know I did it. Oh, just please let me back into your good graces. I only stuck the knife in. This time I want to turn it. And you have to ask yourself, baby, what step are you practicing now? You know? Maybe you'd better be like the robin, make the amends, and then fly away. Sometimes it has to be done like that. You know, sometimes a person might say, well, you know, I've made amends, but now where do I go from here? As far as you can, many times. I found out that that's the way it had to work for me. You know, To forgive means to forgo a situation. To forgo it. And if I can't forgo it, then I have to go. But I must make the amends. But I must, as this child, use them in the right way. Not to just to get up to you so I can finish tearing you up. But what's that? Because every time I tear you up, I tear me down. Made direct to me. It's such we were ever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. You said, well, you know, I don't have to make that amend because, you know, I'll never see that person again. Chance favors a prepared mind. I heard a gentleman last night say, maybe you can't make it to that person, but I can make it in honor of someone else. But amends have to be made so that I can be free. Sometimes when we owe people amends and we can't make them, you see them in your plate. They're on your pillow, and I'm particular about who I sleep with. So I'd rather make amends to you, even if I have to fly, you know. And now, this youngster had to use the muscle of preservation. That's the tenth step, continue. We take a personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admit it. Preservation. After he could walk again, he did not go back and sit in that wheelchair to see how it felt. How many times don't I feel, or did I not feel in the very beginning? Well, you know, I'm going back down here. I'm not going to drink, but I'm going to go in the bar just to see who's in there. No, they want to see you. They know where you live. Preservation. He didn't go back to see who was in the, to see how that wheelchair felt. He continued to exercise. He continued to exercise the principles that he had learned. He continued to exercise the muscles that were beginning to get stronger each and every day. And when one continues to exercise, one begins a feeling of gratitude. That's where we find this gratitude. We find it all through the program, but more so in the 11th step, you know, where we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. See, man's adversity is God's opportunity. Had you and I never been as sick as we were, we never would have known but for the grace of God, would we, you know? And sometimes many things happen to us along the way. And we feel that we're out of touch. But sometimes it's simply just the touch of the shepherd's crook. See, as the shepherd takes his sheep out each day, then when he brings them in the evening, and as they go before the old shepherd, if there's burr has caught on the wool, or there's something, a seed or something in their eye, then the shepherd takes his crook and he touches the sheep that he will step out of line so that he might can administer to him. And many times when adversity happens to you and I, it's simply the touch of the shepherd's crook to tell you to step out of line. I want to administer to you. Now a sheep is a dumb animal. He can't talk, but he can feel. And out of gratitude he goes and he lays his head on the shepherd's knee just to thank him. And you and I have got a tongue. And sometimes we forget to say thank you, God, for all you've done for me. Gratitude. See? That is the touch of the shepherd's crook. You know, our divine Lord healed 10 lepers. Only one went back to thank him when he asked about the others. Remember, you and I came to believe that this would work. And since we did, we want others to feel the same way about it. Gratitude. Remember, man's adversity. You say, well, why did it happen to me in the first place? Man's adversity is God's opportunity. Well, I never did this or I never did that. I cannot see why this happened. It may be for your greater opportunity. Then again, this youngster began to use the muscle of usefulness. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to the alcoholic and to practice these principles in all of our affairs, you know. To practice these principles, all of us. Al-Anons and alcoholics alike, to practice these principles. Because, you see, an Al-Anon to me is nothing but an alcoholic turned wrong side outwards anyway. You know. Same thing. And that is for each and every one of us to be useful to each other. Because that is one of the greatest muscles, is the muscle of usefulness. A plastic spoon is useful. But a silver spoon is not only useful, it is valuable. And when we come to believe that's what we are, we're very valuable, see. Valuable in every respect. In other words, we
The big book says we don't become doormats. And we don't have to. We're royal people. Because we are heirs. And when a person is heir to royalty, he doesn't go, he doesn't crawl. He stands up straight. Now, we're not going to because we are heirs to royalty. We can't save the world. There are many times in that big book will tell you, sometimes we will spoil our chances by keeping on worrying with somebody that doesn't want to be bothered with us, you know. Just leave them alone, go on to the next one, you know. You might spoil the chances for someone else. See, one time there was an eagle, and he was exercising his strength. Oh, my, he stretched out his wings to show his great strength. And he just knew he could do anything. And he saw a seal that had crawled up out of the water, laying on the slime there. And the seal was laying in the wet sand or wet dirt or whatever it is. And the seal was happy laying there. But oh no, this eagle, I'm going to pull him out of there. He ain't got any business in there. And the seal swooped down, the eagle rather, swooped down, and he stuck his talons into the seal. The seal didn't want to be pulled out of there. And in his frustration, you know how you and I can get just like that eagle. And in his frustration, he stuck his talons deeper and deeper. We not only do this in one thing in one part of our life, we do it in all parts many times. When we can't because you're not going to do it my way, we become frustrated and we stick our talons in deeper. I will pull you out. And instead of letting go and letting God, he stuck them in deeper and deeper in that seal. Drug him right on out in the ocean and drowned him. And that same thing can happen to you and I. You know? Let go and let God. See? Sometimes we let our eagleness, you know, get a hold of us. We forget to let go and let God. And like this youngster, to be useful, admit, that's the first thing I've got to do, accept and surrender. Now we speak of practicing these principles in all of our affairs. How simple are the principles of this program? Written down long before you and I ever came into existence, the Micah. How do we do them? Very simple. Love God, do justly, and love mercy, and walk humbly before your God. God bless you.